Vesta, Roy.
Okay, Planck's constant gives you the energy of a photon based upon its frequency.
So that formula we've heard so often, E equals H nu, and one of those is the Planck constant. So if we know the frequency that we're interested in, we know the amount of energy that that wave must have by way of the Planck constant. Is that sort of an interpretation?
Yes, that's exactly it. Planck, unfortunately, gave his name to a lot of things. The Planck constant is just a ratio. There's Planck length. There's Planck time. There's probably all manner of Planck units out there.
And the most sensitive of all the satellites that we use to measure the cosmic microwave background was the Planck satellite, which is the third of the series. And it gives a higher and higher detailed picture, which does show inhomogeneities. There are certain areas of that universe that are hotter than other areas. The difference is fairly small, but the fact that there's any distance at all gives me a little bit of a warm feeling that there could be a multiverse of the kind that I described. Over to you, Roy.
And yet Hawking's promoted the concept that these areas of irregularity were due to quantum fluctuations at the very beginning of the inflationary phase. And that the book Grand Design, excellent book, love a lot of his books. I just don't like when he describes Hawking radiation to simple people because it's not really true. So I don't like when he gives fairy tales. But in the Grand Design, one of the basic things he was trying to promote was the concept that there is no time where the universe began, that portion is kind of rounded out in something he called imaginary time that wasn't time-like. It was more space-like, if you will. So the concept was that there is no absolute moment when the universe began. It's kind of fuzzy at the beginning.
Who is the author of the book we're talking about?
It was co-authored by Stephen Hawking.
And who is the other author? Do we know that person?
I don't know. Hey, what's his name?
Leonard Lodinow, but his name is spelled M-L-O-D-I-N-O-W. He wrote a briefer history of time, you know, to counter Hawking's A Brief History of Time. Leonard Lodinow wrote A Briefer History of Time, so he's known for that. I'm also looking in the table of contents here, also by Stephen Hawking, is a book called Black Holes and Baby Universes and Other Essays. That might be an interesting book if it's a bunch of short essays. Black Holes and Baby Universes and Other Essays. AC2LR, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I just Googled the word The Grand Design, Stephen Hawking and Leonard Molodinow. M-L-O-D-I-N-O-W. Very unusual spelling. So you've already read this book also, Roy, go ahead.
I read most of the popular science books out there. I certainly read everything Stephen Hawking wrote, although he kind of rewrote A Brief History of Time a few times. He kind of milked it for all it was worth. And I don't know for sure, but I think A Briefer History of Time was also co-wrote by Stephen Hawking. Matter of fact, I'm looking at a picture right now, and his name is on the front of it. So, yeah, he just milked that particular title. He had a couple of different varieties of the same book.
Considering the limitations that he had of his physical body, to compose, write, and edit a book with all those limitations, where it takes him, you know, looking with his eyes or flicking his cheek, he creates one letter at a time, and it takes him almost a minute to write a word, so it's a very, very slow process. And so that gives me this particular question, Roy, and that is, I think, and here I might be wrong, that ALS disease is one where the body possibly attacks the sheath to the nerves, the myelin sheath, I think it's called, and therefore the nerves become ineffective and you no longer can command your muscles. So you lose almost all the muscles in the body, except that he wasn't on a respirator, so his lungs kept working and his eyes kept working. There's been some articles I've read recently where, in the case of Lou Gehrig's disease, what is magic about the eye nerves that they keep operating? And if you can find out what special property the eye nerves have that they keep operating, maybe there's some way you can protect the other nerves. You might have some words on all of the above, though, Roy. AC2GS, K2IW.
ALS is a motor neuron disease where the motor neurons are destroyed. The sensory neurons are kept. The sympathetic and parasympathetics are kept. And the involuntary muscles like your diaphragm and your heart keep on going. The reason why you'll notice that he had some degree of control in his eyes and he was finally down to controlling everything with a cheek muscle is more about the length of the nerves in the face, since everything has to kind of connect up to the brain. Those are the shortest connections, so those are the last ones to go. The longer the connections, the more of an opportunity for the disease to disrupt the signal.
Okay, with reference to the eye, I accept that. With reference to the diaphragm that keeps the breathing running, though, that's an awful long nerve, I think. Over to you, Roy.
Yeah, but they're not exactly the same. They're not voluntary muscles. I mean, you can force your lungs, your diaphragm to breathe for you, but if you're knocked unconscious, it still goes on. It's not quite the same as a muscle group that's under your direct control. It's very indirect, and so thankfully it's spared from motor neuron disease.
So the motor neurons get selectively damaged by the disease, but the sensory organs do not. Are you telling me that he had full feeling in his hands and feet, so to speak? Roy, go ahead.
I mean, he might have had some kind of structural damages, because, you know, you can only kind of curl up and have contractures like that for so long before other nerves get damaged on a secondary basis. But for all intents and purposes, ALS totally spares your sensory system. It doesn't affect your, it doesn't affect cognition, obviously, and it doesn't affect sensory.
A living human being of normal characteristics is metabolizing 120 watts worth of air, food, and water continuously. Your 120-watt generator. And because he wasn't moving around very much, maybe he was only metabolizing 100 watts. But to metabolize 100 watts, there's a certain amount of air, food, and water continuously flowing through him. He must have had enough muscle control that when you put food in his mouth, he could maybe chew it or maybe swallow it. But the people who aided him during the last 10 or 20 years of his life, what they had to do to keep his body clean, I won't go into any more details. My goodness, that takes a rather strong dedication, as I see it, to do that day in and day out. Over to you, Roy, K2IW.
AC2GS. Well, indeed. I mean, it's not only that he had an form of ALS, but that he was treated as close to a king as you can be treated. They were fastidiously maintaining him. And unfortunately, there's a lot of things that had to be done. They had to put a tracheostomy tube to clear his airway. I'm willing to bet you almost anything that he had a feeding tube, that they didn't feed him for years except through a tube which hooked up to his stomach. And he probably had other tubes involved. It was not a terribly attractive look, but, you know, it got him through 76 years, which is quite amazing for any variation on ALS. He lived, and, you know, I mean, we're talking like a regular human being without ALS who made it to 115.
It sounds like he needed aid of other human beings 24/7. Because of his fame, you could usually find somebody to do it. If he didn't have that fame, I think you would have great trouble finding those volunteers of the Aurorian.
Yes, fame or money. I'm sure if, God forbid, the Queen of England had this problem, she would make it to past 76. So money is just as good as fame. But yes, he required an entire group of people. He had a graduate student who basically wrote all of his stuff that he sort of dictated. He translated material to him and from him. There were always nurses. He actually ran away with one of his nurses. He divorced his first wife, married a nurse, and then divorced the nurse, and I think he went back to the first wife.
Certainly a very interesting man, and good to discuss him and figure out how it all came about. I think we're getting way beyond the point where we should go over to the space report. And Roy, interesting stuff. I think we've used up most of the questions that people have. And thank you very much for Science Physics Report number 22. And now I think we should go over to Space Report number 292. And Paul, WS2N, what are those space people doing this week? You got it, Paul. K2LIW.
This is WS2N. That was a great topic. Following Hawking, that whole last hour, that was terrific. Riveting. Very well done, Maury. We talked about the test telescope that's going to be launched, the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, many times on the net. Well, it's about to go up in a couple of weeks. April 16th it's going. NASA's going to launch it, and they're paying Elon Musk, SpaceX, to do that. It's going to launch out of Florida, and it's going to go into an orbit. It's going to go out to the orbit of where the moon is, and then back to around Earth, and back out again. 14 days, every 14 days it will do that. And TESS is a space telescope that's kind of going to be replacing Kepler. And Kepler's in a different kind of orbit. It's in an Earth trailing orbit going around the Sun, a heliocentric orbit. And it's been doing that for quite a few years. And Kepler's actually gone through two iterations, you know, Kepler 1 and then Kepler 2, after they had problems with keeping the telescope position, the gyros spinning. There's four of them, and then if two fail, that's it. You know, but they were still able to keep it going. That's kind of on its way out, and that pretty much on K1, the main mission of Kepler. It's there at one position in the sky, at Cygnus, in the direction of Cygnus, and it really looked at 150,000 stars just in one location, one small location in the sky. And as the planets would go in front of the sun, it would be able to detect the light loss from that, from their sun, from their stars, and it would be able to tell you, you know, what size the planet is, and how close it is to its star, what the orbit period is, and all of that. And they've come up with thousands of exoplanets just from K1. During K2, after parts of the satellite started to fail, they put it into a different position just looking out away from the sun. So as it went around the sun, it would look at different parts in deep space away from the sun. As it continued all the way around 360 degrees, it would get a complete look. And it, you know, in that extended mission, it still found, you know, another 1,000 planets or so. Now, TESS is going up, and TESS will be looking for planets going around stars that are close in, maybe a couple of hundred light years out instead of 1,500 or 8,000 light years out. It's going to be looking in the 200 and 400 light year category. And the information that you can get from, you know, for this mission that's coming up, if you tune into NASA TV this Wednesday, March 28th, at 1 p.m., they'll have, you know, the director of the program, they'll have the principal investigator on, other scientists that will be involved with this project. And no matter how much you read about the different telescopes or whatever missions are going up, when you see these news conferences, they usually last about an hour or so from NASA, and they have all the experts on. And you know, if you miss it, they tend to replay it. You always can learn a lot more, find out more about the mission than what you normally can just from reading about it on the internet. With that, there's another mission that was just approved by the European Space Agency. It's called Ariel. And that's a long acronym, but it's, you know, it's Atmospheric Remote Sensing Infrared Exoplanet Large Survey. I had to write that one down. And we have one called Finesse, and that's going to be our version. This is the European Space Agency version, and it's just been approved, and it will be looking at certain planets that, let's say, TESS finds. TESS will find a planet going around a certain star, and this one, Ariel, will look at that particular planet and try to figure out what the atmosphere is made out of. Certain different information. It's got all kinds of spectrometers on board, which will help it do that. Now, Ariel, it turns out, is one of the many space telescopes that was in the Scientific American magazine that you told me about, Dick. Let me drop it. Happened to be on page 38 of that March issue of Scientific American. And so, yeah, that was a good issue. I did pick that up before it disappeared from the newsstand, so I got a chance to read through that. But it turns out after reading it, the very next day, I read on the internet, on the European Space Agency site, that Ariel has now been approved to launch. We have a long wait before it does. 10 years from now, 2028, it will be in the P2 position near where James Webb Space Telescope will be. They're going to send it out there. So, thanks for that, Dick, because I got more telescopes to space telescopes to read about from that. You know, Plato and Euclid, solar orbiter. I just briefly went through some of those. But Ariel has definitely been approved. There was a launch to the International Space Station, and that just went up last week. It was Wednesday. Got to see that live afternoon here, but it was a night launch in Kazakhstan. And three people got off the ground safely on a Soyuz MS-8 spacecraft from Kazakhstan. Drew Beisel, American, Ricky Arnold, also an American, and Oleg Artemov was the commander, the one that flies the Soyuz up to the space station. So they'll join the other three that are presently up there, and in fact, they've already joined them. It was a two-day process to get to the space station. Spent 34 orbits, and they docked with the space station, opened up the hatch, and they're inside now doing science. In fact, they're getting ready for a spacewalk this weekend. They're going to do a spacewalk. They have to go outside, and one of the guys that just went up there, Arnold, will be going out. He happened to be, in his previous life, a science teacher, so he'll be transmitting a lot of science back down to the ground for kids in high school and college, and even grade school, all the information that you get from NASA when you set up a teacher is well worth it. Let me drop it. WS-20. One of the astronauts on board already was an American. The other one was another Russian, and the other fellow was a guy from the Japanese Space Agency. So you have one guy from Japan, two from Russia, and the other three are from the United States. So they'll be up there for quite a few months now. So they come back, you know, it's a rotating system, you know, and we've been doing this now for 17 years, constant people on the International Space Station for now over 17 years, so that's pretty good. Another topic we've always talked about on the net is plutonium-238, the manufacturing of plutonium-238 for NASA. The supplies have been running thin in the last 10, 20 years, and there has been a movement, a development in creating more of this stuff. So in a couple of years, they expect to be making 2.5 kilograms, roughly 5 pounds of this plutonium-238. And the reason 238 is so important, that is the plutonium that they use for radioisotope thermoelectric generators, which have flown many, many times for decades on end, including the pioneering missions and the, to the outer planets, and including the Viking missions that landed on Mars in the 70s, the Voyager missions, which are still going, Voyager 1 and Voyager 2, which now takes, Voyager 1, it takes now almost 40 hours to transmit to Voyager 1 and get a return signal. Voyager 2 is a little bit less, but it's still operating after 40 years, and what's making that work is this plutonium-238. We have it on the Mars rover, Curiosity. We don't have it on the other two rovers, Spirit and Opportunity. They were solar driven. But Curiosity has an RTG, radioisotope thermoelectric generator, as well as the 2020 rover that will be going up. Very similar to Curiosity. Kind of looks the same. Kind of the same design, but much more improved. Better wheels to one. The wheels on Curiosity are in bad shape. But it will have a RTG on board. And since they found a way to develop more of this stuff, they have now approved a couple of other further missions that would not have been approved. For instance, now they're planning on developing, they call it Dragonfly. If they can get Dragonfly off the ground, they would love to, the scientists would love this, because, and so would the engineers, because this one is designed to go to Titan, back to Saturn, and, you know, Cassini has just finished up over there. But this thing would go back to the to Earth, Saturn's moon of Titan, and land on that moon. After landing, it's a big thing, maybe, you know, a couple hundred pounds. I think they said like a 1,000-pound thing, but, you know, maybe 500-600 pounds, I guess, on this particular moon. Actually, it's about very similar to our moon, the gravity. Dragonfly would have this, they call it a quadcopter. So, a dual quadcopter. So it would have, instead of four spinning blades, it's going to have eight. And they'll be located over one another. So if any one of these fails, it would still be operating. Titan has a very dense atmosphere. It's more dense than Earth. About four times as dense. And a similar gravity to the moon, so it's very light gravity. So it would be the perfect environment. And by the way, there's no wind. It would be a perfect environment to fly one of these things in. I mean, with the heat shield, drop the heat shield off, open up the parachute, and have this dragonfly land on the ground, on Titan. And now you have this spinning quad. It's really like a fancy drone, because it's going to have eight blades. We'll be able to fly and go to different locations on Titan. You know, most of the times it would be on the ground and doing science, but, you know, when the time came, they'd be able to launch this thing. It would take quite a bit of power to drive these blades. But with the batteries on board that they'll have, they'll be able to do that. Keep the batteries charged. You can't use solar power because there's not one big cloud over Titan, and plus you're too far away from the sun. So because of this excess plutonium-238 that they plan on having, this dragonfly will be able to utilize that power supply. So I thought that was pretty good. Another one that is looks like they could go fast forward with is Europa Clipper. Europa Clipper was planning to go, you know, they're planning to use it anyway. It, you know, with the budget that they have, no problem. But now they're thinking about sending a lander there, maybe with an RTG on it, maybe not. But because of the budget that just went through, then NASA was going to get like $19 million, and now they're going to get $20.5 million or something. So it's $1.5 billion more that they didn't figure on. They're thinking about adding that money to a lander for the Europa Clipper, going to Europa around the moon around Jupiter. So we'll see how all this develops over the years. Just one other topic I just wanted to mention, and, you know, this is pretty far-fetched, but it is possible they're not paying for it, but in the future, on Mars, they would like to be able to build what they call the vacuum blimp. You know how you have these dirigibles, zeppelins, and blimps on Earth? You know, you fill it up with, in the old days, hydrogen. Nowadays, helium, because, you know, you don't want any more Hindenburgs. But nevertheless, you're filling it up with these light gases, and the thing takes off and flies around the planet. Well, that won't work on Mars. But what would work on Mars is something called a vacuum blimp. So you build this structurally thing, and it would be quite large, actually. But this in the future, you might even have people there. But you just want to get from one location to another, they would have what you call a vacuum blimp. The structure on this would be like a lattice structure, so it would be a solid thing, so it doesn't collapse from pressure. Not that there's much pressure. That's why they think they could use it on Mars. Mars has like one-tenth of the pressure that we have here on Earth. You know, so one-tenth of 1% that we have here on Earth. So, but actually by creating a blimp with a solid structure, and you take all the atoms that are on the inside of this thing out, the thing will actually rise, and it would be able to go around from place to place. I thought that was interesting. That sounds like a good physics question. You know, if you take some solid sphere and take the vacuum out of it and put it on Mars, would it float? And apparently, according to NASA, it will. If you plan on doing that on Earth, they've done the math on it. There's no structural object that they could build that would be solid enough on Earth to withstand the outward pressure of 14.7 pounds per square inch. It would crush the sphere. So they say that's why it wouldn't work on our planet, and that's why nobody's ever built it. But because of that low pressure, extremely low pressure, and because of what it's made of, the molecules of the carbon dioxide, that's what most of the atmosphere is on Mars, because of the density of that, they believe that this theory isn't, you know, probably going to be on the planet at this time. You know, you'd have to build this thing, it would have to be like 50 meters, they said, like a huge, you know, 150-foot-long craft would have to be built. I was just fascinated with the idea that, you know, this thing would fly around just by having a vacuum inside. Let me drop it. So that's pretty much it. You know, we have InSight is going to be going up in May. We'll cover that in the next couple of weeks. And that's also a Mars mission. And that's no rover. It will land on Mars. And it will do some seismology work. Investigate the interior of Mars and talk about that. In May, it will be going up another 6 or 7 months to get there. Interesting thing about that, though, it will be launched from Vandenberg Air Force Base instead of Florida. Florida is a little bit busy now with all the launches, and they figured, well, it's not that heavy of a spacecraft that's going to go to Mars. Let's launch it from California. So it's the first time California is going to get an interplanetary launch. That's pretty much it for the SpaceNet report for this TechNet. We're up to number 292. Back to you, Dick. K2RR, WWS 2
m Pigeon AC2LR.
You've got a K.
Paul, what was the last word on water on Mars? What were the rovers finding? Can you remember?
Go ahead and pull on that one.
Yeah, remember those, what was it called? Lineas. These lines that they found on Mars, and it looked like it was water going down a hill, and they were pretty much sure that this is probably, you know, brine or some kind of like water mixed with salt, so like a brine running downhill. They're starting to believe that that might not be true. So that might be a problem. Now, they do know there's solid ice on Mars. If you go to the northern hemisphere, back in 2007, we landed the Phoenix spacecraft on Mars in the northern hemisphere. And in fact, that design is very similar to InSight, the one I was just talking about, that's going to be going up to Mars in May. And I had a scoop on board, and you know, with no wheels, but you know, where it landed, was able to dig into the ground, and they found that, you know, as it dug down, they saw this white substance, and then the next day it was gone. So that was ice. It actually evaporated. So they know there's ice there, but no real like pools of water yet. If there is anything like that, it might be very deep. That's pretty much it. AC2LR, WS2M.
I do remember reading a number of articles recently where They've discovered on Mars quite a number of rock structures that show evidence of past water, and these nodules also a function of past water. So there's a lot of evidence that water used to be on Mars, but because of a lack of a magnetic field and a lack of a Van Allen
repeater, timeout.
Mars lacks a lot of the structures that allows it to hold on to its substances, so it's been losing its atmosphere and losing its water, and so there's not very much water left. And life as we know it requires water, so was the water there long enough to form life in the past? And could that life get to the point where it could tolerate the desert-like atmosphere it's got right now? And so finding life on Mars, I still think it's going to be awfully difficult, and the amount of water there is awfully small. And that white substance that you find below the surface near the poles, in some cases it's a frozen carbon dioxide, in some cases it's frozen water, and maybe it's a mixture of those. Give me some comments on that, Paul, and then pass it back to Kay. WS2N, KQIW.
Well, if they tested it with the Phoenix lander and whatever procedures they used, they know that was ice. But it's not, you know, there's the difference between ice and liquid water. Good thing is you could melt it if you were there. And Spirit found it too when it was getting dragged. You know, the wheels were broken and it was getting dragged. Sand away, dirt away, and sure enough, they found similar frozen things under the wheels of Spirit when it actually stuck and trying to get out. But, you know, they've confirmed that. And yeah, the CO2, well, that sure comes in the wintertime. That's how come the Phoenix mission ended. They knew it was going to end because it was in the northern hemisphere and it gets covered up with really dry ice, carbon dioxide, that condenses and destroys that spacecraft. So that's the story on that. The water that they will find up there is going to be ice, from what I see. They probably have to go very deep, where drill down very deep to find any heat. You know, the deeper you go, you're going to find some kind of heat, and maybe you might find something. We'll see. You know, they could always take that ice, melt it down, separate the ice, get hydrogen, oxygen, oxygen to breathe, of course, water to drink, and hydrogen to use as a fuel. KOVU, AC2, LRWS1.
When Dick mentioned the recent article, I quickly looked on my phone and I found from November of 2017 a space.com article where they were saying they're seeing dark rivulets on the surface indicative of salt water, salty liquid water running down the surface. Well, they used spectral analysis from the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. Says the dark streaks, which appear seasonally, were confirmed to be signs of salty water running on the surface of the planet. That's what I thought I had heard. But I thought it had been debunked after that. So maybe that's what you're saying. And I also have a question. The ice that they found at the pole, do they know that it's water ice, H2O, or is it frozen methane or something like that?
No, that was confirmed as frozen ice. So, you know, we could always find that real quick. You put in discoveries of the Phoenix Mars mission. They'll tell you that. You can find the pictures of it. I remember seeing the pictures when the scoop dug up the sand or the dirt. They were shocked to see this, and then the next day it was gone, you know. And then our curiosity, too, they have a way of testing everything. So they found some water droplets in some of the things that they removed from the ground on curiosity. you know, they know it's there. But as far as, yeah, I'm trying to think of the word that they use, something linear. I'll look it up on the computer. And that's these, like, sand dunes, little hills, and you can see these dark structures. They look like little, very little tributaries coming down from the and every season it reappears. But then they said that, yeah, it was pretty much debunked. They realized it could be coming from some other process. It escapes me what it was. So that's not confirmed, as far as I read. Back to you, Ken.
Okay, thank you so much. I love this discussion. It's been a great net. AT2LR, back to you, Dick.
The air that's in the room with you right now, Paul, comes very close to obeying the ideal gas law. That's a fancy way of saying, once you fix the temperature and pressure, there's a predictable exact number of molecules that are in that air. Okay? That air contains oxygen, nitrogen, and a few other trace gases. The oxygen is in the form of O2. Each oxygen molecule is molecular number 16. O2 is 32. Nitrogen is 14, so N2 is 28. When you go through all the mathematics of air in the room with you has a gram molecular weight of around 28.5 grams, which turns out to be very close to 1 cubic foot. So 1 cubic foot of air, 28.5 grams. If I now fill up a balloon with helium, helium has a gram molecular weight of 4 instead of 28. So helium is 7.12, 7 and an eighth times lighter than air. So your balloon filled up with helium, the volume of the gas inside the balloon is 7 and an eighth times lighter than air. That's where you get the lift from. If I fill it up with hydrogen, hydrogen has a gram molecular weight of 1. I don't think hydrogen forms H2, although there I'm not sure. So it's either got a gram molecular weight of either 1 or 2. So hydrogen is almost 7 times lighter yet. If I fill up the balloon with vacuum, that's got a gram molecular weight of 0. So as long as I can take care of the outside air pressure, and I put nothing but vacuum inside, it's a hell of a lot lighter than helium. Even much more lighter than helium, much more lighter than hydrogen. And vacuum is the lightest thing in the world. As long as you can keep the outer structure strong enough to hold down the air pressure. The air pressure on Mars is 0.7%. So it's 0.007. of the air pressure you've got on Earth. By you and my standards, that's very close to a vacuum. It's probably the amount of air pressure you get is, I'll pick a number, 120,000 feet, way beyond the top of Mount Everest or whatever. So you get very little air pressure. But you still need this very large volume of this vacuum blimp. It's going to give you the lift as long as you've got that structure. But that very large volume is not something you can easily transport to Mars. So how do you transport that thing to Mars and then set it up on the planet? Is it somehow built in sections and glued together or bolted together, do they say? And where did you read the article on the vacuum blimp? Very crafty idea. Hope you pull K2LIW. I'm hearing that for the first time.
Okay, and yeah, before I answer that, this is for Kay. It's called Recurring Slope Linears, RSL. That's what I was trying to think of. The RSL, Recurring Slope Linears, and the article I read was in The Verge on the internet. The Verge is very good. There's a lady science reporter there that's very good, and a lot of times she's on. They'll put her on NPR radio. I kind of trust The Verge as far as the science articles that they come out with. They said that, I think that was flowing sand. They think it could have been flowing sand that made that, those marks in an intimately. But yeah, I know a lot of people, the reports came out even by NASA, this could be it. These are, this, you know, recovering slope linear, this could be water. We're going to send the next rover maybe there and really check it out, but that never happened. As far as the blimp goes, first heard that on NPR every Friday from 2 o'clock to 4 o'clock on NPR radio. They have different stations that you could listen to. I listen to 105.7 here in Ronkonkoma. I guess that's the best. And they talked about this blimp. It's called Science Friday. Science Friday with Ira Flato. And they talked about this blimp that this guy wants to eventually create, put on Mars. But it sounds to me, it's so big that maybe this will be after we have people there. I would imagine this thing would be built using, you know, maybe some of the infrastructure that's on Mars. You know, maybe they could manufacture it there. And then they'd set up this trust. They would be setting up this trust type of structure, you know, to make the blimp where it wouldn't collapse. So that's where I first started, Dick. And then naturally I researched after that. And it's not on the drawing board to do it, but it's one of these things that they would like to do in the future, because they could fly it around from different places, you know, and then if it required it, you know, to come down a little bit, they could add a little air in there, and they could have this compressor, essentially a vacuum pump, to pump it out again if they had to. It would be a lot better than solar, you know, a solar-powered thing. And to get electricity, I guess they could always put solar panels on the outside of his body, and they could power this thing. Back to you, Dick.
You've been telling us about these rooms that have been added to the International Space Station, which are inflatable after the put up into orbit. Therefore, I see the possibility that you could make this vacuum blimp in such a way that it folds up origami style. And once you get to Mars, you inflate it, it pops out, and maybe you install some rods or whatever on the inside to give it a little bit more structure. But I could see ways that you could accordion pleat it to make it compact for shipment, inflate it to pop it out into its erect position, and then vacuum it to get the lift that you want. So I'll bet you they're going to do something along those lines, Paul. And yes, I've seen I've heard these radio programs by Ira Flato, Science Friday. When it comes to the Europa Express, if I remember correctly, Europa is the second of the four Galileo moons of Jupiter. Io, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto. Let me drop. And Europa, I think, is the one where they see geysers of water squirting out of this planet. It seems to have a thick ice surface, and they believe liquid water inside. So as such, after the Europa Express gets there, does it intend to drill a hole through the ice and see whether or not they can find microbes in the liquid water that's probably on the inside? Have you said anything along those lines? Over to you, Paul, K2LAW.
Yeah, that would be in the far distant future, because they'd be happy to get a lander there to dig down into, you know, you might have to dig down a mile through the ice to get to actual water on Europa. They might have a better shot at, you know, taking the orbiter. You know, you're going to go back to Saturn, and you're going to have an orbiter. The lander would go down, but the orbiter would be called the Europa Clipper, and that would be orbiting Jupiter, orbiting Jupiter, and you just keep going past Europa 40 different times. And the reason for that, you don't want to orbit Europa because it's in the radiation belt. You know, the spacecraft is not going to last long. So they just want to zoom by, get a little information, transmit it back to Earth. There is another mission that they would like to do, going to Saturn, where Enceladus is. That's the one with the water shooting up hundreds of miles in space that Cassini photographed. And Cassini also went right through it to figure out what it was. So they confirmed that it's definitely water coming from the planet, from the moon, Enceladus. But, you know, they would like to get another spacecraft back there. But that's not on the drawing board as far as I know. But that's the one with these geysers, let's call them, shooting out of the moon. As far as I know, Europa does not have that. If they do, I missed it. But, you know, that's the moon that looks like a gigantic cracked eggshell. It's all white. A million cracks. That would be the one. A lot of planned missions, but that's one of them. And they plan on launching it with the SLS system, Space Launch System. So it's not going to take like forever to get there. You know, you're going to cut your time down in half if they use the SLS. Unmanned, of course. So, you know, SLS is being designed for manned space missions, but also for unmanned space missions like the Europa Clipper mission. Back to you, Dick.
In Antarctica, they've got this huge cosmic ray detector. I don't know the exact dimension, but I think it's around a cubic kilometer. They've got a whole bunch of pipes that go down a kilometer with detectors, scintillation counters, so that when a cosmic ray comes along, hits the water, hits the ice, creates a flash of light that the scintillation counter sees. And by looking at the array, this cubic kilometer array, which one's fired, you can figure out the direction of arrival. So they sunk those pipes in the ice of Antarctica by putting hot water through the pipe, and the pipe essentially melted itself through the ice. So as long as you've got a source of energy that can heat water and you pump it into the pipe, drilling down a mile is not very difficult. So the Europa Express, landing on the ice surface of Europa, if it's got a really potent thermal electric generator, could melt some of that ice, take the water that they've now heated, put it into the pipe and pump it down, and then push the pipe through the ice. And that would be a way that doesn't require drilling to get through that ice, to get to the water that's underneath. And I didn't say it's easy, but it's a possible way. They probably haven't said anything along these lines yet. So what's the major thing they intend to do when they land on Europa? Just look at the surface and measure the gravity and seismic things up, Paul? WS2N, K2LAW, we're getting close to the cutoff time.
I don't have the kind of details of what they would be doing on the surface yet. I mean, it was shelved, and now they're thinking about bringing it back, and they probably will. The holes in Antarctica, they drilled down, and then they set these spheres down, and the spheres have the detectors in it and wires coming up to the surface. But then those holes get refrozen, you know, inside of a couple of days. You think they're frozen back. They don't send the pipe down and leave the pipe down there. You know, they drill a hole, they send these things down, and they're frozen. They will be there for the end of time. You know, they might go, you know, half a mile into the surface, whatever it is. And that's what happens with those detectors. So even if you have that system on Europa, you drill down. And Europa, you might have to go down a mile or two, I don't know. And then it would freeze behind you. So the most you could do is get down to water. Their main goal would be eventually to put a submarine down, let it swim around. lot of pie in the sky things that they would like to do, but they're going to cost many more billions of dollars than the $20 billion that they just got. By the way, it's $20.7 billion for NASA and $700 billion for the military. So, the space program for the military is usually about twice or three times that of NASA. Back to you, Dick. WS2X.
Okay, Don, good information, Paul. Very good information also, Roy. That was TechNet number 1692. That was Space Report number 292. And that was Science and Physics Report number 22, with a lot of information about Stephen Hawking and black holes and so on. You're allowed to make suggestions as to what order, how much, and what you guys want to hear on the TechNet. So, 73 you all, be kind to each other. I'll pass it over to Roy and then Paul, if either one wants to make any final comments. But thank you very much, both of you guys, for your participation tonight. AC2GS for any final, C2RIW and the TechNet. Bye-bye.
AC2GS, thank you, Dick. Thank you, Paul. Thank you, everyone who participated. Once again, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Give me topics that you find interesting that I can explore for the sake of everyone else. And have a great week. Until next time. Bye, guys.
The time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater.
Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, code number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Welcome to the W2VL repeater.